Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Sarah LaDuke, in for Ray Graff this afternoon. I will also be here tomorrow afternoon. So if you are a Ray Graff super fan and you turn it off when it's not him, just don't turn it on tomorrow. It'll be me again. But Ray will be back on Tuesday. Actually, I'll be on Monday, too. Oh, no. The Ray super fans are going to cause a scene here. Today, we reconvene the Science Forum as our experts are ready to respond to your questions. The phone number to call about anything scientific, and they will either assign themselves homework or take a swing at it, is 1-800-348-2551. That's 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. That is VOXPOP, voxpop@wamc.org. With all of that being said and established, as we wait for your calls at 800-348-2551, let us have our team of experts sign in, please. We'll start with you.
Hey, welcome, Sarah.
Thank you.
I'm Barbara Brabets. I'm a biochemist from SUNY Cobleskill in the midst of finals week.
Oh, thank you for taking the time out. My goodness.
This is a nice break.
Oh, good.
I'm Roger Giuboni. I'm an electrical engineer, and I own a company called Rogers High Fidelity. We make audio equipment.
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist and mostly retired.
Congratulations.
And I'm Ed Stander, also from SUNY Cobleskill, and I'm here just to answer anything that nobody else can answer.
Great. So before we go to the phones, there was quite a large aurora incident last Friday night in our region and around the country. Let's talk about that a little.
It was the best date night ever, let me tell you. My husband and I drove around, and we thought we would start about 9:30, and about 10 o'clock, we were able to finally see what I thought was pink, which is not the first color I thought I would see on an aurora. Usually it's green, but I saw the pink very, very clearly, and it got better over the next hour and a half. It waxed and waned, but as the clouds broke up, it was pretty awesome, and my little old Samsung took some great photos.
Wonderful. Did any of the others of the panel see the aurora?
I did. We saw some rose-colored hue in the sky. It was tough to tell whether it was actually aurora-related or a result, you know, just of the sunset, the normal red, the red fade that you see on a sunset. Anybody have any insight as to the difference in the colors as to why?
Yeah, it's oxygen and nitrogen.
Yeah, okay. The oxygen.
So which colors are related to which gases?
The higher up oxygen is the red color, and kind of lower level oxygen as far as altitude is the green. And then the rarest color is that pinky purple, which is nitrogen getting excited, which
in
is
the lower
just
atmosphere.
Lower atmosphere, but right. Still above, like, I don't know, it's you know, like 100 miles up or so. Not quite miles, 50, 60 miles up. So we're not talking where planes are.
So
we're
this was a
G5 still.
Level storm, which is on a scale of 1 to 5, it's, was the highest level. But it turned out that the coronal ejection was not facing the Earth, so it didn't have the same dramatic effect as, I think it was, what, 1859?
Yeah, the Carrington event.
The Carrington event,
and even
exactly.
Back in, what, 1960s, when the power went out on the whole West Coast.
Right, the Carrington event States. Is interesting. It actually set telegraph stations on fire.
Right,
there were telegraph
right down
stations
the wires.
That burned down as a result of the Carrington event.
I guess that CME must have been pointed right at us.
Right.
And good news is that there's another one coming over the side right now in the next 3 or 4 days. It shot off what's called an X-flare, an X3.5 flare, which is one of the biggest ones.
Okay.
And but it's a glancing blow, Ed?
That was a glancing blow, but the next one, as it goes across towards us, it's going to get bigger and bigger.
Ooh. Now, these happen typically in 11-year cycles, right?
Yep.
And we're right at solar max just about now.
I think we're a little past the solar max,
no,
aren't
it's
we?
No, it's the end of 2024.
Okay.
So are we anticipating or hoping for more opportunities?
It depends
to see
on whether
lights.
You're a telegraph operator or not.
Or if you like
radio. Well, what's interesting is it wreaks havoc on radio communications.
Right, and GPS.
Well, GPS because of the satellites
right.
And the although they're all radiation hardened, they shouldn't be damaged. It may affect their ability to operate,
right.
But they won't be damaged as a result.
But the ones that really have the problem are the ones that are in low altitude. Because when the magnetosphere starts to shrink because these things hit it, the atmosphere gets pushed in as well, and they start burning up.
Because they're moving in altitude, because they're basically stuck where the...
Right. They're up where the oxygen is.
The occupants of the space station actually have a hardened shelter that they can go into.
Ooh. Yep.
a radiation-hardened shelter that they can go to when they know that this coronal mass ejection is headed our way. But it does wreak havoc. The high-frequency communications bands from like about a megahertz and a half to 30 megahertz were totally shut down. I mean, now, totally shut down.
I'm not familiar. Who's using those bands?
It's a mix. There's transportation. So aircraft use them when they go across the oceans because mm-hmm. typical aircraft communication is VHF, like the frequency of WAMC. But once they go across the ocean, they no longer have line of sight, so they use what is called HF, high-frequency communications. Navigation uses those frequencies. Amateur radio operators use those frequencies. And a lot of municipal services use those frequencies, timekeeping and so forth. And if you looked on a what they call a waterfall chart, so it's a running chart of frequency versus time, and normally you see activity in there depending on what frequency, and it was just totally blank. I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah, last 2 days have been the same too.
This morning was a little active. I was actually on the radio this morning. I could hear Florida and California pretty well, but usually this, you know, midday in around 14, 15 megahertz, you can easily communicate with Europe and so forth, and none of that. You couldn't hear any of it.
1-800-348-2551 to pose your questions to the scientists here on the Science Forum on Vox Pop today. Let's go to the phones, and we start with Rob in Hebron. Hello, Rob.
Hi, yeah, thanks for taking my call. I have what might seem like a silly question, but the components of water are hydrogen and oxygen. And so why can't we burn it?
Because basically it's already been burned.
What?
So true.
Yeah.
Oh, God. The
energy that comes from combustion, a good portion of it is hydrogen that's baked off the fuel combining with oxygen because those oxygen-hydrogen bonds are very strong. And that means when they're formed, they give off a lot of energy.
It's very hard to break up water.
Yep.
You have to put a lot of energy in to do that. We do that experiment sometimes in lab, and we have to take electrical currents to actually separate them back out into the hydrogen gas and the oxygen gas.
Yep.
If you think of carbon dioxide, too,
right?
So carbon dioxide comes when you combust hydrocarbons, right? Carbons and hydrogens. The end product is carbon dioxide, so oxygen stuck to the carbons, and water, so oxygen stuck to the hydrogen. So everybody gets an oxygen today, right? So, and what happens is, the energy difference between the bonds before and the bonds after is what's released as heat or light or electricity, whatever you want to make into it, whatever type of energy you want. So it's kind of, water is a low energy profile molecule in that sense. In fact, most reactions that make water will happen spontaneously at room temperature.
Yeah. Same thing with carbon dioxide, kind of on the energy ladder. Both water and carbon dioxide are really low, that anything that ends up making those molecules, those are good reactions.
Well, good until they accumulate in your atmosphere and make you hotter.
Yeah. good meaning that they go well.
Yes, I mean,
they blend
from a chemistry perspective, not from a world perspective.
No.
All right. All good, Rob?
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a great day. Let's go now to Lou in Pittsfield. Hello, Lou.
Hello. I have a question about ethanol in gasoline. And my question is, why does it separate? And when it separates, it doesn't turn into alcohol and gasoline. The bottom layer won't even burn. It's more like water. Alcohol doesn't turn into water. So what's going on there?
Well, if there's any water that gets into your gas or condenses from moist air, then that will separate and take the alcohol with it because the alcohol will be more soluble in the water.
But if there's no condense, if the vehicle is parked indoors, it does it as well. So there wouldn't really be that great of a temperature differential.
Well,
it's not temperature, it's humidity.
Condensation.
Right? Yeah, it's not humidity. Temperature, it's humidity.
Yeah. I'm speaking kind of speculating about what the mechanism is here because I don't actually know for sure. But I think that water must be involved in that in order to get the phase separation?
A good rule of thumb here is when you put your vehicles or your tools away, when we fly airplanes and we park the airplane for more than a couple of days, we always park it with a full fuel tank so that the condensate can't form on the walls of the tank. That's exactly what happens.
Mm. Right, and then it'll just gravity will just drip it down.
Yeah.
So you're saying that this is simply, it's not that they're not selling us alcohol, it's that they're, see, I thought maybe they're not actually selling us alcohol. They're selling us water.
No, it's alcohol, but effectively that's what dry gas is for. When the gas gets too much water in the system, that removes it, and effectively it drops to the bottom with the alcohol.
Right, because dry gas is just methanol, which is ethanol. Alcohol. It's alcohol, but not the drinking kind. So, yeah, the reason, and back to your original question, the reason why the ethanol or the alcohol attracts the water is because they have similar type bonds. I mean, it's almost like you talked to the guy before this question. But because they have OH bonds in them, they are attracted to each other. There's a phenomenon called hydrogen bonding that happens. If you have OH bonds in one molecule and in another molecule, they will kind of hang out together and solubilize, join forces. The gasoline does not have this capability, and that's why they don't mix, right? That's why oil and water don't mix, because oil has no hydrogen bondings. Water obviously does. And ethanol and water do hydrogen bonds. So they'll commingle. That's what makes a great martini.
1-800-348-2551. Thank you for your call, Lou. 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum with Barbara Brabitz, Ed Stander, Roger Jabroni, and Jim Pickett. We will be back after this break. Welcome back to the Science Forum on Vox Pop. I'm Sarah LeDuc in for Ray Graff. The phone number to call, 800-348-2551. The email address, voxpop@wamc.org. And this is from James, who emailed and says, or asks rather, what are the 5 smallest particles in order from smallest to largest, and how do we know?
Gosh, what do we call sub? Do we go subatomic, or do we stay with particles?
Well, I guess if it's subatomic, there are 3 flavors of neutrinos. Those are
chocolate, vanilla, and strawberry.
Yeah. You wish.
They have mass.
Maybe,
they definitely have mass.
Maybe,
but very, very little, and nobody knows how much.
Maybe.
And the question asks about size, and then we're saying that large or small mass means small size, and it doesn't necessarily have to be so.
Size in terms of
subatomic particles,
the dimensions really doesn't make any sense on the primary particles.
Once you get smaller than an atom.
Right. It's hard to get them all lined up so you can see which one's the smallest and which is the largest.
That's right. They're the dwarves. Yes. They're hard. They're difficult to prioritize.
So that's why it all goes by mass.
But of the protons, neutrons, and electrons, the smallest, I don't know. I don't know which one's smallest. I know which one's lightest. Well, electron's the lightest by far.
Yeah. And again, it makes no sense to say how big an electron is.
Right.
The nucleus, a proton is big enough that it does have a size.
Sure, and a neutron as well.
And a neutron.
But not an electron.
Right, and an electron, it's the Heisenberg uncertainty principle talks about how it's difficult to find its location and know what its energy is at the same time. And apparently that also means we don't know what size it is. Now, that's us at the table. I'm sure somebody's speculated what the size of an electron is. But it's tiny.
Yep.
But very powerful.
1-800-348-2551 to participate in Vox Pop to pose your questions. And we go to David and Troy. Hello, David.
Hello. My question is about the spacecraft that just keeps going and going and going away from us. I think it's called the Explorer, but I might be wrong.
Voyager.
Voyager, yeah.
That's it.
And it's equipped with sort of like supposedly easy to read package of messages. Isn't there a gold LP on there?
There is,
yes. Old school grooved LP.
Yep. CD, yep. Yes.
Okay, and there's other things. Oh,
with
there's
music
other
by
things
David
like a
Lang.
Plaque with the. And,
and a picture.
And there's a plaque with.
Right, and Da Vinci's
of the Pythagorean
Man.
Theorem.
Yep.
And Guccian music from China.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. So my question is, what was the point in launching this thing, given the odds of it ever encountering anything? Okay, but it's going to go on for a long time, so that helps with the odds, right? The odds are slim, but it goes and goes and goes.
Well,
but then even if it encounters something where there is life, you know, beyond mold and fungus, like life that actually thinks about something, why is it assumed that some other intelligent life form has ears like ours? I mean, if they actually had ears like ours, then they know that little collisions make noises. They might figure out how to stick a playing card in the goal, you know. But the idea that life forms have our features to see the plaque.
All right, we got the question. Ready for the answer?
Yeah, the answer is very simple. The Voyager probe weighs a lot. And its purpose was not to send a disk out into space, but to take pictures of Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune back in 1972. And the fact that there was a little spot on the inside of it that was just the right size for a CD meant let's put one on there and maybe it'll make some difference someday.
It's kind of whimsical as a contribution.
It's totally whimsy.
It's like me going off to a business conference and bringing my swimsuit. I'm never going to have time to use that swimsuit. I'm at the business conference doing my business conference things. I'm not in the pool or in the hot tub, but I bring it along because it's really not that heavy.
And actually, after the Voyager took off, there were a lot of companies that made copies of this thing, and people made a lot of money on it. So there was a purpose for it there as well.
The answer is capitalism.
It is, yes.
Thank you for your call, David. Let's go now to Kevin in Red Hook. Hello, Kevin.
Hello. We know that the temperature is getting higher, but it seems to me that it's been windier lately over the last than it was years ago. Would anyone know if that's true or not?
Is it getting windier?
Yeah, it's a lot of it has to do with where the jet stream is, and at the moment, the jet stream is moving from the south to the north, and it's bringing a lot of hot air in. And the hot air is mixing with the cold air coming from Canada, so you get a lot more wind as a result of that. So that's my partial answer.
But general surface heating would cause more wind, too, as a result of increasing temperatures.
Yes, yeah. Although that's more vertical than horizontal.
Right, so it's not windier everywhere, is what you're saying, Ed? It's that it's really where you are relative to where the jet stream is above you?
Well, that's a good part of it. And, of course, the what's called the isobars, which define areas of high pressure and low pressure, if things keep on moving from west to east as fast as they have been doing, those isobars get compressed, and that causes more of a downdraft, if you will, which brings even more wind in.
Kind of like traffic backup of the wind.
It may be one of these matters that as the globe warms, one would expect more wind, but the other fluctuations that happen, like with the jet stream moving around, and will make that very difficult to tease out of all the noise. So it's more likely that if it's enough to notice, it's probably weather and not climate change.
We did have El Nino recently.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm.
1-800-348-2551, 1-800-34-TALK-1 to join the conversation. And we will go now to Merle in Argyle. Hello, Merle.
Hello. I'm having a little problem hearing you with this phone, but I'll get my question out. Can you hear me?
Yep,
we
go
can
ahead.
Hear you, Merle.
Okay. This has to do with microwave and ants. I put in a muffin the other day, and I didn't see it, but there was a live ant with my muffin. And I cooked it for a minute. I would assume the ant would have died, but when I opened it up, the ant's still running around. And then I ended up doing it again to warm up the muffin again, and the ant's still alive.
I'm not taking this one as homework. I'm just telling Sarah I am not doing the microwave ants experiment.
I'll take the answer on this one. Super ant. Next? No, just kidding.
Cockroaches are going to make it. Why shouldn't the ants, right? I'll take a stab at it. The microwave oven frequencies are set at the water resonance frequency. Okay? So when you put meat in a microwave, and they're typically about a megahertz and a half in that range. Gigahertz and a half in that range. And what happens is the water molecules, when they hit that frequency, they vibrate, they shake, and they generate heat as a result of the vibration, which gives you the cooking. It's not the radiation that cooks it, but it's the vibration of the water molecules. My suspicion, and it's only that, is that the ant has very little water in him. You know, he didn't drink a lot that morning or whatever, but he had very little water in him. So it really didn't affect them. Now, it may long-term affect them, that exposure to that microwave energy. That's an ionizing frequency. But it...
No. There's no ionization on microwaves.
No ionization on microwaves?
No, it's lower energy than visible.
Yep. It's just causes rotation.
Okay.
Yeah. Bond vibration.
So it's just vibration.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just friction of molecules, basically. Yep. So like rubbing your hands together makes your hands hot.
Dry ant is what it is.
Or he has a very bad headache.
A super ant, like I said, from science. Yeah. No, just kidding. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 or voxpop@wamc.org. Justin emails in and says, I have heard that bacteria play some role in rainfall specifically or the water cycle generally, which isn't a question, but I've heard this. Can you comment? But then also says, bonus question, what is Schumann's resonance and does it have anything to do with thunder? Any or all answers appreciated. So,
is a very, that's packed. I teach both microbiology and water chemistry. And so you've just taken my Venn diagram and covered them over.
Cool. Teach two courses right now.
Yeah, right. on the radio in a minute and a half. Where do you begin? Water itself, the molecule, not really affected by bacteria. Water can go through the membrane of a bacterium the way they can go through the membrane of any cell in our bodies, any cell in a plant that we all require water to live. That is the case. One of my research studies is to look at bacteria in water as basically a signature of human use of water. So you could take water out of the Hudson or the Mohawk or this great Sacandaga Lake or Lake George and look for caffeine. Caffeine does not occur naturally in this part of the world, right? We don't have coffee plants growing alongside the banks of Lake George. But if caffeine comes out in our urine, then it will be present in the waterway. So you can quantify, and there are people who get big spreadsheets out and do this, quantify how much contamination from urine and feces there is based upon the concentrations of caffeine in water. You can look for chocolate residue, which sounds a lot better than what I look for, which is I look for the poo. So we look for the bacteria that eat the poo, and how concentrated the bacteria are tell us something about the human impact.
On the other hand, and just to add to that, bacteria can cause rain because the bacteria acts as a nucleating source for the water in the atmosphere. And it's been shown that if there's enough bacteria coming out in the atmosphere, that it actually produces the water glumps on, if you want, to the bacteria, and that allows it to form a drop. You need to have something to form a drop, or else you can take water and bring it down to minus 50 and it doesn't form a drop. But with the bacteria in the atmosphere, it actually does do that, and it can cause rain.
So it gets in the upper atmosphere through convective activity?
Correct.
Yeah, or dust or forest fires,
right.
Whatever.
Right.
And then Schumann's resonance?
You know Schumann's resonance?
I think it was a B flat.
It's a variation in the Earth's electromagnetic field. It's about 8 hertz, and it resonates. And I much more than that, I can't tell you.
Do you know if it has anything to do with thunder?
I don't.
It should not.
I don't think so.
Thunder is. Yeah, we can hear thunder, so that's not at that same frequency.
It's a very low frequency resonance.
Got it. Well, I mean. I understand that that's the end of the statement. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We will go now to Mark in Catskill. Hello, Mark.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having the show today. A couple of things came to mind when we were talking about hydrogen bonds. Matt Damon's character in The Martian had to make water to feed his potato plants, and so he got hydrogen and oxygen and burned them. So when he said that the water had already been burned, that seems to be the case.
Yep, that's exactly what he did, and he did something with hydrazine, too, I think as a fertilizer. He did a chemical reaction with hydrazine to get some nitrogen-containing materials to help enhance the soils that didn't, the Martian soils that just didn't really have enough in it. So, yeah, I mean, he said he scienced the you-know-what out of that place, and he really, the science was pretty, I mean, it was still feasible, if not a little spectacular, but it was still feasible. Yep. Good show.
It's a movie.
It's a movie.
The other thing was when you're getting on to alcohol and water and the hydrogen bonds that are shared there, I had an eighth grade chemistry teacher, I think, if I remember correctly, he said that if you took a liter of water and a liter of alcohol and combined them together, you'd get about a liter and a half.
That's about right. Yep. They mix together. So, yep, the molecules kind of squeeze into the elevator all together and take up less space.
Awesome. Sarah, thanks for taking on to Ray today.
Oh, sure. Thanks for calling in. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551 to ask your question to the Science Forum this afternoon, or you can email voxpop@wamc.org. Willard writes in and says, the dandelions on my lawn are 2 or 3 inches high at most. In a field of tall grass, the dandelion flower stalks can be 6 inches long. How does the dandelion know to grow its stalk that long?
It's a great question. There are sensors, right? Photosynthesis is all about being available, or it's a process that requires sunlight, and so there are photosensitive portions of cells in higher plants that orient themselves, just like sunflowers, towards the sun, and they aren't going to expend extra effort to grow taller when they can get the same amount of sun where they are. So it all has to do with intensity, and actually there's certain wavelengths of light that they're looking for. If the wavelength, if the intensity and the wavelength of light is correct, then they're not going to grow out any more than that.
Do you think that there's some selection for short dandelions
in lawns?
Because...
Deer seem to eat them no matter what, yeah. Whether they're tall or long.
Yeah. If you look at country dandelions growing in fields, they grow up tall.
Yeah. There's more competition.
Right, they're competing with the grasses around them for pollination and stuff.
Even when it's fairly open, but maybe then the selection pressures are that way.
And of course,
whereas suburban lawn dandelions tend to stick pretty close.
And there's different varieties of dandelions as well. They're not all the same. So in a certain area, the dandelions may grow taller simply because there are a different variety of dandelions.
So, I mean, I think that goes to Jim's question that we may be selecting by having our lawn, we select one of the varieties or species of dandelion as opposed to the taller ones. Well, that's a thought.
800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Speaking of pollinators, where does the science panel stand on No Mow May? What do we think about it? Have we all know about this movement?
I wouldn't have been able to leave my house if I hadn't mowed yet. I wouldn't have been able to escape.
We did no mow in the backyard until about 2 days ago, and then we left a corner.
Okay.
That is still big. That
is still tall.
So the ground ivy loves it, and
the pollinators love it. They really do. I mean, the bumbles were out first. The bumblebees were out first. And now I saw honeybee the other day. Mm-hmm. So they're having a grand old time.
Yeah. And lawnmower companies love it as well.
I've never seen bees in grass. They're attracted to grass. When you say no mow, you're talking about grass.
Well, you know, you've got, right? I don't know. We don't have these kind of golf course lawns, right? They're kind of a mishmash of whatever will grow, like
mine
the dandelions.
Certainly is.
Yeah,
yeah,
right? I have a golf course.
Oh, you do?
Yes.
Oh.
I work very hard at that.
I bet you do.
No, so. mine is an eclectic mix.
So it's not the grass they're attracted to, but it's the other things that we grow
it's
in.
It's all the flowering. Flowering stuff. Yeah,
my lawn doesn't have any of those.
They love the ground ivy and
the water.
Dandelions.
They love the dew in the morning.
Yeah. And my lilacs are loaded with bees right now, and I love the lilacs, but I'm
allergic. Are your lilacs blooming more than usual?
No, they're behind.
Oh,
so
okay.
It was colder.
Yeah.
They're behind.
All the azaleas and other flowering trees that I've seen in Albany are fuller than I've ever seen them in the there for 20 years.
Yeah. Well, I got a tour of the Tulip Festival area by the Albany Gardener, the Albany City Gardener, and she was saying that things were just way advanced because it was super, super cold,
yep.
and then it got super hot in Albany, and then they all just kind of got together. The earlies and the lates were all blooming at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. It's very colorful right now.
For some reason, my lilacs are not doing nearly as well as the other flowering things. Part of it is that they get pruned by the deer.
Sure. Yep, that will have an effect.
yeah. But even the ones that are out of reach, for some neighboring lilacs are good.
Well, my lilacs, which I prune myself, I don't eat them, but I do prune them with, you know, pruning shears to try to get them to flower. This winter was very hard on the lilacs. There were a couple of storms, wind storms, and then some ice or big heavy snowstorms that really bent them. So they've been under considerable stress. Mm. So it could be that even the ones that are too high have just had a stressful winter and now just need a vacation.
Yeah, me too.
1-800-348-2551. I think you're flowering beautifully, Ed. 1-800-348-2551. Barbara, Ed, Roger, and Jim are here to take your questions, and we will return with the final segment of this afternoon's Vox Pop after this break. Welcome back to Vox Pop. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Ray Graff, here with our scientists for this week's Science Forum, Barbara Brabitz, Ed Stander, Roger Jaboni, and Jim Pickett. The phone number is 1-800-348-2551 and the email address voxpop@wamc.org. Let's go to Jeff in Jackson. Hello.
Yes, good afternoon, and thanks. I was reminded by one of the early questions that I have a terrible pet peeve, and I would like to quibble with the terminology. I recall when they had finally weighed the top quark, they talked about the top quark as a particle. And when I found out that it only existed for like 10 to the minus 23rd seconds, it seemed to me that that's like, it's not really, I think a particle should be something that has some stable structure. And I think this was something like a substructural fragment or something. I don't know why we call that a particle if it only exists for like 10 to the minus 23 seconds.
Well, we don't. We call it a subatomic particle. So it's like having a Lego. You haven't built the whole model. It's a piece of the whole model, right? The particle of particles is the atom. Right, and there's 92 naturally occurring different varieties, but that's
no, but they're structure, solid structural entities.
Right. Well, let me try to give you an analogy. If I left $1 million on the sidewalk outside 318 Central Avenue in Albany, how long would it be on the sidewalk before it got snatched up? Not that it wouldn't take long. So the quark doesn't disappear; it is absorbed and then is. In with the other subatomic particles become something else. It's a piece of a larger puzzle. So it doesn't like poof disappear. Yeah. It gets absorbed
no, it
and it becomes something
immediately.
Else. It doesn't fall apart. It becomes something
absorbed.
Else.
Yeah, and the especially with the subatomic particles, the particle is more of a technical term by physicists. It really doesn't mean the same thing that we when we talk colloquially about a particle, you know, like a speck of dust or a grain of sand. It's not like that at all. It's in fact, it's very difficult to get your mind around what it is because it is unlike anything that we have experience with in our real world.
I think maybe that's the problem I'm having.
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's completely understandable.
You just can't. And physicists have added to the problem by talking about things like particles being in two places at once, and that melts your brain, because the particles as we know them in our experience in the world can't be in two places at the same time. So
okay, well, I really appreciate taking your time. Thanks so much.
Sure, thanks for calling.
Yeah, I'd like to add.
Of course, Ed.
Yeah, of course, because I'm here.
That's not what I meant. No, but go ahead.
But I'd like to add that if we discover something or we see something, we name it. That is what we do as human beings. And we call it a quark. We could have called it Fred, but we probably have another particle already called Fred. So it's a placeholder until we know what to do with it. It's something we don't really understand what it is, but we know it exists, and therefore it must have a name.
Yeah. And quarks, how they determine mass of the quarks, I don't know, because quarks really do not exist independently. They have to be in association with other quarks.
Absorbed, right.
Yeah.
1-800-348-2551 or voxpop at wamc.org. Andrew wrote in and asks, is there any evidence or science that studies the effect of these New Age rockets such as SpaceX Starship? Something seems odd about a 40-story building flying into the air with a flame trail three times its length. Is it safe for the atmosphere? One might be okay, but what happens when we commercialize it like passenger jet planes?
Well, one thing I can mention is that every time you send a rocket ship up into space, you actually change the speed of the Earth because it takes a certain amount of angular momentum, that's right, of the Earth in order to get it up into space. So you send enough of them up, you can actually change time.
Yeah, and there is
concern. No, I don't want to. Let's not.
I saw that in the Superman movie. It didn't really work well.
And there is concern, actually, about things going both ways, about the what the rocket exhaust can be doing in the atmosphere, and also the effect of things burning up. Coming down, because there's all sorts of metals that end up then in the atmosphere that normally aren't there.
And so unlike quarks, atoms don't disappear. And so you're going to be breathing in, only you're going to be breathing in gaseous metals instead of solid metals. So you won't even know what's going on.
Now, let's talk about that exhaust for a second. That exhaust, aren't they primarily alcohol and oxygen engines? Some of them may have some different variations on that, but most of that should be water, that exhaust.
Most of it should be water.
So that reduces that risk significantly. In terms of the burning up, yeah, it stays in the upper atmosphere. Very few of them actually re-enter the Earth.
Yeah.
And you're saying that
it's a matter that I have read articles in Science, for example, discussing this.
Now, you're not confusing that with the space junk problem where we have satellites that have exploded.
It's stuff that's actually entering the atmosphere, burning up. I mean, it burns up.
Doesn't it become a vapor at that point?
Well, yeah.
Atoms don't disappear. They're still there.
It's vaporized metal.
Yeah, well, some of it does. I mean, every day about 11,000 tons of meteoric dust comes into the atmosphere.
Yum.
And if you put I talked about this before, you take a bucket and you put it outside during a meteor storm and put water in it, and then the next day take a magnet stick it in your hand with the magnet in there, you actually pick up a bunch of the meteoric dust. So it's always there and it's always coming in.
1-800-348-2551. Now to David on the Mass Turnpike. Hello.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
I'm on.
You are.
Okay. My question, I've been contemplating a theory that's come out recently called assembly theory. Are you familiar with that?
Assembly theory.
I am shaking my head no.
No.
No. We're good. We have all those and some Googling maybe.
Well, it's a theory put forth suggesting how life might have arisen from non-life. And as I understand it, it's suggesting that when molecules reach certain levels of complexity, life arises from non-life.
There are multiple parallel theories of the origin of life that don't involve like hitching a ride on a meteorite, right? Where from first principles, from the atoms that are deposited here on Earth, we could have created ultimately proteins, so amino acids are. We've tried. When I was in graduate school at RPI, there was one lab where they took these huge bowls of goo and they would put in all of the kind of clays and stuff from different around the world, and then they'd throw electrical charge in it, and it was like Frankenstein's lab. It was so cool because there's like things going on, and then they'd let the lightning hit this clay mixture for weeks or months, and then they would go and analyze what kind of molecules were made by adding these high energy bolts of lightning into this existing clay. So these kinds of investigations have been going on a long time. There's many parallel theories of how this could have come about. I understand from the literature, having read it, that we have made small proteins, 10, 15 amino acids long, out of what is without the hand of enzymes to do it, so on first principles, and then some nucleic acids, but not the ones that we make. So our DNA is made up of A's, G's, C's, and T's. They made similar molecules of similar ilk, but not the varieties that we're going with now. Does that kind of, did so I miss a piece of your question?
I guess there is another piece to it, but it kind of rests on, you know, the notion that assembly theory might have some validity. You know, so I think what you're saying there is, you know, we can create the molecules that we associate with life, but what manifests the transition? Of course, there is the problem of how do you even define life, I suppose.
Well, the transition would be having to wall off all of these molecules behind a membrane. That's the line. The creation of a cell.
Well, we've done
or at
that.
Least creation of an environment, right? And we have. There's naturally occurring things called myceles that can create a barrier where the stuff on the inside of the mycele is at a higher concentration than the stuff on the outside. Because if you have these like magic molecules, if you want to call them that, that are created through these lightning storms, you don't want them dissipating and going off their separate ways. You need to accumulate them in order for there to be these spontaneous and natural reactions that happen that we call life, that we call biochemistry. That's why I'm a biochemist, because that stuff's cool.
Okay, so the second part of my question, which is sort of playing off the assembly theory, is I've always been fascinated with consciousness and non-human consciousness. You look at things like an orca, which has a brain which is much more massive, arguably more complex than a human brain, but they don't have hands to manipulate the world, and they live in water besides, so they're going to have a totally different experience of life. And on the other hand, there seems to be a lot more in the literature about consciousness than plants, however you want to define consciousness, which is another challenge, I suppose.
Yeah, the consciousness in plants is really bleeding edge science. It's beyond the leading edge. It's because we don't have the tools quite established that are validated that allow us to measure things that would be like a nervous system in a plant. Plants don't have a nervous system per se. So the idea that the hypothesis that plants communicate, which we now know that they do, and that they can communicate different messages. They're not just binary on-off messages, but there's a variety of messages that they can communicate to their community. Does this mean that they have a way of determining it's time to communicate this message beyond it's sunny, it's dry, it's wet, it's fall, it's summer? So that is the kind of idea of a nervous system that is the hypothesis that there might be an equivalent of a nervous system or a consciousness or a sentience in a plant. I don't think sentience is really what we're talking about here. I think it's more an awareness of its environment that it can express in more than binary on-off means.
Yeah, there's a whole... You have to think about this as on a continuum.
Mm-hmm.
The first step of the continuum would be a thermostat.
Do they have consciousness?
Well,
not yet.
No. Well... That would be one on a scale of one to a gazillion.
Okay.
The thermostat would be one. Now you start building up, even single-celled bacteria can respond to its environment. That may be a three on the scale. But so it's not really possible to say exactly where you're going to put a line and say, below that line, there's no consciousness.
That's what we do
at
Kobelskill.
And above the line, that there is a consciousness.
That's what we do at Kobelskill. We give tests.
Yes.
It's another reason for a no-mow May. This way the grass isn't screaming outside when you're cutting.
Oh, my God, it's terrible.
It would be. It really would be. 1-800-348-2551, a phone number I probably didn't need to give again since we are nearly done.
The whole sentience thing, it's mind-blowing because we do ask this question over again.
Of course.
And then the question I say is, why are we asking that question? Do we want to impart our own value on our own self-importance on other animals or say, no, they're not as important as we are? Like an orca plays with its food just like a toddler. It throws the seal around in the air and then finally eats it.
They're killing sailboats these days.
Yeah, for fun. Gangs. They're calling them teenage thug gangs of orca that are going out and wreaking destruction. So, you know,
on yachts, so.
Yes, right. An occasional kayaker, but no big deal. But, you know, so is sentience a good thing? Look what happened with the orca. So it's a lot.
Let's see if we can do a really fast one. I bet we can't, but we'll try. Richard, can you ask your question very quickly?
Yes, you're talking about oxidizing. I want to know if you take a methane molecule or a mole of methane and you oxidize it, how much energy is released forming the carbon dioxide and how much is released forming the two water molecules?
It's 812 kilojoules.
I know this because I just...
Approximately.
I just graded 95 tests with that question.
Incredible. That's amazing.
So how much comes from carbon dioxide?
Oh, well, it's the breakdown. It's really just the breakdown. I don't know. As far as the it's mostly from the methane to the... That's the methane breaking down. The oxygen bond is the delta H of F is zero. So it's 812 kilojoules-ish.
Yeah.
I would
guess that most of it comes, or a greater proportion comes from the formation of carbon dioxide.
Oh, yes, than the formation of water. I was thinking more of the breakdown of the methane. Yeah. It's all the breakdown of the methane. Yeah, it's minus 284 for the water. So you take 560.
This is math. They don't want to hear math.
Yeah.
They want
a lot. 560 kilojoules is a lot of energy.
And music. All right. Thank you, scientists Barbara Bravitz, Ed Stander, Roger Jaboni, and Jim Pickett for being here. We appreciate you and your participation in this wild experiment. Support for Vox Pop comes from Sunmark Credit Union, partnering with NYSERDA to help foster energy independence and provide renewable energy lending options with their new solar lending program for homeowners and businesses, sunmark.org/solar, and Buxton School, Williamstown, a community and arts-focused boarding and day school, grades 9 through 12, hosting an open house May 25th at 10 a.m. Live your education, buxtonschool.org for reservations. Thanks again for joining us on Vox Pop. Our engineer was Zach Malloy. Susie Check, I took your calls, and I'm Sarah LaDuke. Tomorrow on Food Friday, we will talk about gluten-free baking with Melanie O'Malley of O'Malley's Oven in Troy. Talk to you tomorrow at 2 p.m. Stand by now for the Capital Connection.